With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey there, and welcome to episode 36 of Kneel Before Odd. I'm Audrey Kearns, your host, and my, oh my, what an interesting podcast I have for you to listen to right now. My guest is prolific actor Peter Breitmeyer. Peter has had numerous roles in television and in film. His resume includes A Serious Man, The Middle. Recently, you saw him knock it out of the park as the unforgettable Lieutenant Schmidt in season one of Fargo. You'd also recognize him as Bill, the guy from another insurance company in the Progressive commercials. And this November, Peter will be appearing in the next chapter of the Harry Potter universe in the movie Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them as a character named Gilbert Bingley, which is so cool, and we do get to talk about that. But an interesting thing happened on recording day. Peter is from Minnesota, and about an hour before we recorded this podcast, the terrible, terrible news was announced that Prince had died. We were both still processing this information when we began recording, and I remembered he was from Minnesota and lived in Minneapolis, so I asked him if he had any memories he could share about growing up there when Prince came out on the scene. And boy, did he have some great memories, including seeing Prince live many times and then getting a close-up look at an old house Prince used to live in, sneaking up to the house, as a matter of fact. And of course, the house was purple. That's a really fun story. It was a lovely conversation about what Prince meant to us. And it was sad, but it was very cathartic after just hearing that news. And after we discuss that, we also talk about his comedy nerd origin story and how he got into acting, studying comedy at the famed Dudley Riggs Brave New Workshop in Minneapolis. He also shares stories from the Fargo set where he worked side by side with Billy Bob Thornton and Bob Odenkirk. And then yes, we talk about Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I got as much information as I could out of the man without having him violate any NDAs that he signed. He told me how he got the job, the audition process, which is really interesting, what the shoot was like in England, the impeccable sets, the costumes, and mustache fittings. Yes, you heard me correctly. And working with director David Yates and actor Eddie Redmayne. So please, please enjoy episode 6 of Kneel Before Odd with my incredible guest, Peter Breitmeyer. So please enjoy episode 36 of Kneel Before Odd with my incredible guest, Peter Breitmeyer.
Internet, heed this call. Open your minds and ears and prepare yourself to kneel before Odd.
Hello and welcome to episode 36 of Kneel Before Odd. I'm your host, Audrey Kearns, and this is a show where I interview geek patriots. And today my guest is stage and screen actor Peter Breitmeyer. Peter is a versatile actor with an incredible resume, which includes a television series, Fargo, Horrible Bosses, The Middle, A Serious Man, and the highly anticipated upcoming film, Fantastic Beasts, and Where to Find Them. Thanks for joining me, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Odd.
Odd. Thanks. Now you sound like my mother or my father.
They started when you said Odd, so I thought,
yeah,
I'll
it's
say
called
Odd.
Kneel Before Odd. Yeah. Yeah, that's what my parents always called me, and then my friends started to call me Odge.
Odge.
Yeah, just like, hey, Odge, come over here. And then my dad heard it one day and said, I didn't name my daughter Odge. I don't even know what that means, Dad. But
yeah. Just indignant for no apparent reason.
I guess.
I will not have that in this house or this neighborhood.
Exactly. And the same thing happened. My sister's name is Alicia. And she's like, okay, everyone, start calling me Allie. And so we all start calling her Allie. I did not name my daughter Allie.
Your dad, I need 5 minutes.
I need.
Bursts into his office and slams the door.
Exactly. He's like a 30-year military vet. So he's like all rigid rules.
This will not happen. This will not stand.
Well, so I usually start my show asking what my guest nerd origin story is, but about a couple hours ago, we got some terrible news, and I realized when I was crying about it that you're from Minnesota. We just found out a couple hours ago that Prince died, and I was curious, since you're from Minnesota and lived in Minneapolis, did he have an effect on you? Were you a fan?
Yeah, I think me and almost everybody in Minneapolis is a big fan, and really, you know, Prince became prominent during a time when Minneapolis and Minnesota was just starting to get noticed by the rest of the country.
Right,
you know what
right.
I mean? So the fact he kind of led the way. I mean, you know, the Coen brothers made Fargo, and that became a thing too. But Prince was kind of our guy that we'd point to and say, "See,
yeah,
aren't we have creative people here and interesting artists
more
and stuff?"
Than
yeah, and so and you know he built the big place out in Paisley Park out in Chanhassen, which is kind of a hilarious location for him to build a big studio.
Why is that?
Well, because Chanhassen is very.
Is that an area of town?
It's a suburb of Minneapolis, and it has like the Chanhassen Dinner Theater, which is like four different stages, and you can sit and you can have you know your chicken cordon bleu and the whole thing, which is really fun, and then great productions, like very professional, very you know. And, you know, I do ran there for 25 years or whatever.
Wow.
In one of the theaters, but it's just very out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, Paisley Park at one point was still had like cornfields next to it and stuff like that. You know?
Wow.
And I think, you know, he built it out there to get, you know, for sound reasons and to, you know, cheap land. And,
is that
know,
just his recording compound or did he live there as well?
Well, it was at one point just a recording compound because when I went to college, I went to a little college called Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota, and I had a roommate my freshman year, and I went home with him one week and just for fun to see his family, and he lived on this lake out in Eden Prairie, and he goes, he gets me in the boat, and he goes, I want to show you something. I'm like, oh, okay. He goes, this is something kind of cool. And we get on the boat, and we ride for a while on the boat, and we kind of start to pull up, you know, off in the distance, I see this purple, just ranch-style one-story house
purple.
It had a big, like, maybe 3 acres, mostly grass running down to the lake, and just, but the house was, like, structurally completely unspectacular, but it was purple.
I love it.
We dried the boat up, and he kind of, for some reason, knew that Prince wasn't home or something like that. And there wasn't like guards or anything like that. So we pull up to his dock and we get out and we're walking around Prince's purple ranch house.
Wow.
You know, and he's like, and this is where Prince lives. And I was like, gosh, are you serious? Really? Is that right here? Yeah.
That is amazing.
So, yeah. So that was interesting. And, you know, I've seen him in concert numerous times. He gave fantastic concerts if he really, really loved the crowd. If the crowd wasn't giving him what he wanted, he'd have his concerts tended to be shorter.
So you saw him enough times to see like different temperatures.
Yeah, I think I saw him like 4 times.
Yeah.
You know, which is not as many as some people I know. But
right.
You know, my friend Missy has seen him like, gosh, I don't know how many times. And my
right.
friend Brad, the guy that I do progresses with, Brad McDonald, he's seen him tons of times. You know?
Right, right.
So yeah, anyway, it was sad news. And you know, 57 years old, the guy looked like he was 35.
He did. He did not age. And it's just like one tweet I saw today was, are you trying to tell me that he was mortal? You know?
Yeah.
It's like we all thought.
Absolutely.
Because he didn't age. And I grew up in a really small town in Florida and went to Catholic school and everything. So, you know, when I first heard Prince, it was just like, oh my God, that's what you go to purgatory for. You know, Sister Mary would be what he's crawling on the ground in that video
exactly.
when doves cry.
Yeah.
You know, but what was so interesting
There's
to me.
There's stuff flowing out the end of his guitar. What was that supposed to mean?
But it also made me feel things that I've not. That I never felt before. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about, you know, just what funk can do to the body and what good music and art can do to the body. And seeing him be sexual, like when in that video, when doves cry, when he's crawling on the floor, that's something that women would do in videos, not men.
Yep.
And here he is, a guy doing it and being perfectly sexy and
yeah, and comfortable doing that and just making that choice, you know. And I saw him at First Avenue, which is kind of, you know, the venue that people know about in Minneapolis because of Prince, even though it's been a music venue for a long time. And, you know, I don't even know if it's open anymore. Might be. I don't recall. But, yeah, I saw him there numerous times. And just, you know, back during that time, you just couldn't believe it. I mean, you couldn't. It just was incomprehensible that somebody would perform that way from Minnesota. You know, it was just so
you were so
excited about it because it was just such a breakaway manner to behave. Yeah. You know, and it wasn't that we were all, you know, stoic Midwesterners and stuff like that, but it just wasn't the culture to be that free.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even if you were in a rock band. You know, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of great, like the Replacements, like all these great bands out of Minneapolis, fantastic. But just Prince's show, the show he put on.
It was a show.
Unlike
it was a piece of art.
Yeah.
You know, like I said earlier, you know, having a 30-year military guy for a dad, and my mom was, you know, a cryptographer for the State Department, and I went to Catholic school. I know, right? And so there are a lot of rules in my house.
Oh, God, that's so rich. That was just rich.
I know.
Oh, my
God. Oh, God. I can interview myself for an hour.
I just love it.
But no. So, you know, like I said earlier, the feelings that he made everybody in my small town feel, and just it was inspirational as well.
Yeah.
You know, my sister was the biggest Prince fan I knew, and she drew a symbol on a jacket, and she started a quote unquote gang, as much as you can in a small town in Florida, called the Chosen Few, which was like, you know, a lyric from a U2 song, but with Prince's symbol, and they drew it on their jackets and everything. And it was just,
it's important.
It was such a way to express ourselves when we were, you know, middle school in our teenage years. I don't know. I cried when I found out. Did you shed a tear, or are you still kind of? You said you just found out an hour ago.
I was a little bit. Yeah, I was a little just kind of. I was just shocked by it.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, to be honest, it's like, it's just feeling like Groundhog Day. I mean, you know, like David Bowie dies, and he was like even huger to me than Prince was. You know, and you know, just all these people in the last year, and we're all kind of getting to the. Or at least I am getting to the age where this is going to be a more common experience.
My
all the
husband
time.
Just said that this morning.
It's like when you're
Peter.
In your 30s, you don't have you're not surrounded by deaths occurring as much because your friends aren't dying or your friends' parents aren't dying yet. You know, so I've got all these friends with parents dying. I've had a few friends die too. You know, and now like you've got your icons that you grew up with musically and theatrically and everything like that. You know, passing away, like the number of actors that have done, you know, I mean, I was just the most epic Philip Seymour Hoffman fan ever. And
that
just
was a
devastating to me, you know, because it makes me think like when people like that pass away, especially when they're not terribly old, you kind of go, that person had 30 more years of artistry that they could share with us. And that's not going to happen anymore. So the things that we have are what they did from now to the past, and that's it.
That's it.
You know, and so, you know, Prince at 57, it's pretty devastating. You know, I mean,
that's
like,
young, you know.
Yeah, when Joni Mitchell dies, I'm going to be a mess.
Really?
Because she's like my favorite singer-songwriter, and she's had a huge impact. I mean, I know it's funny, my musical tastes are kind of all over the place, but yeah, so I haven't shed a tear yet, but I just, because I feel like, I just feel like we've gotten hit so many times in the last year, and I'm just sort of
over the last
four
months. I mean, you know, David Bowie. I cried with that. I mean, talk about affecting people across the spectrum. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, Democrat, Republican, foreign, American. It doesn't matter where you are. David Bowie affected you somehow with his art. And I had heard rumors for about a year prior to that he was sick. Uh-huh. And so I remember going, oh, okay, that makes sense with the rumors I heard. And then it was still absolutely horrible. Where Prince, I was just blindsided. I remember reading something last week that he was in the hospital. And like, you know, but they said it was the flu.
He'd gotten sick, and they had to land a plane in Illinois. Something like that, yeah.
And you know, now there's all this speculation. There's going to be speculation for the next 3 days. So I just turned the TV off. Because I was just getting absorbed in the TV, and first thing CNN is their first guest is Larry King, and I'm like, really, you're gonna have Larry King give perspective on Prince's death. Yeah. I think I need to turn.
And it's like, part of that, I guess he was roaming around the studio.
But you know, my husband said, he said, he was available.
Yeah, he was available, so that's the guy. It's like, but why? Yeah. Why him? Yeah. And I look at, like, you know, with Dave Bowie, like his last, this album that was released.
Oh my goodness.
It speaks so much to what, I mean, I just think it's about him knowing he was going to die.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. I think it was just like, this is my journey right now, and I'm dying, and this is what I'm going to leave. And that's just, oh my goodness. But you're right.
God bless Prince, man. He was just, man. I mean, it's just, now I just want to, go home and like listen for a day and a half.
Yeah, which I think a lot of people will be doing. I'm sure I'll be doing that after you get out of here.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that with me,
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is your nerd origin story?
Well, I kind of have two, as you mentioned to me before the show, they're not sci-fi related, but they're more related to
what are you geeky about?
Utter geekdom.
Yeah, yeah.
My first utter geek out.
Right.
In terms of comedy, because, I've always been into comedy and, like my first play that I ever did was in seventh grade, Little Mary Sunshine or something like that. And then I just took off. Oh, just that rocket to the moon after that production.
I love it.
One school play after another. People grabbing at me. People wanting me for this project and that project. No, I've got to do.
I can't the salesman sign your over autograph here. Right now.
Yeah. I've got Guys and Dolls to rehearse. I can't be. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So I started collecting, when I was very young, I started collecting Bill Cosby albums.
Okay.
And I just think the story is interesting because of obviously what's happening now with Bill Cosby.
When that started, where you are now.
Yeah, compared to now, yeah. And so I ended up with like 16 Bill Cosby comedy albums, and I would listen to them and memorize them and kind of do the routines to myself. And I never kind of got groups together to do them for friends for some reason. I guess I was too—
Were you doing them in the mirror?
No, I would just sort of put the album on and I would kind of do it as he was doing it.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And then I might like pause the album and see if I could kind of replicate the delivery, and the dryness or the this or that, or the little lilts, And so I would listen to these albums and I had some rare ones too. I had like one called 200 MPH, which is kind of they didn't print that many of them. And the one that my mom wouldn't let me have was he had one called For Adults Only.
And of course she wouldn't let you have that one.
Allow me to have that one. But when I was 14, I lent them to a guy named Brent. I won't say his last name.
Okay.
And actually, he ends up being a hero at the end of the story. And he was a high school friend. And he'd say, oh, can I borrow your Bill Cosby? They're so funny. I say, okay, yeah, but these are really a big deal to
me. How many did you lend him?
16.
All 16?
Yeah.
And oh, my goodness.
He had them for a couple weeks. And I was like, hey, Brent, did you listen to those albums? He goes, I'm still listening to them, blah, blah. And he went to Apple Valley High School. And I was at Rosemont High School. I would do summer theater with those guys. So I'd see
you were
them,
making it.
Because I was making it. Yeah. I was all over the place. I was Rosemont, Apple Valley, all the southern suburbs needed me, wanted me. So I had friends at that school, but I didn't see those guys every day. So I finally, I keep bugging him about him and he doesn't bring. And then he moves. And then I'm sort of like, I'm young, so I'm sort of forgetting about it. And, I wasn't really, I mean, it was the one thing, one of those belongings that was important to me, but I've never been like a really obsessive, belonging person as far as things. But so I just kind of, it slipped my mind for a while. I was like, oh, what the heck happened to those? Oh, that's Brent still got those. I don't even know how to get a hold of them. This is like way, in the 80s, and I couldn't find them. And then I kind of knew, somebody said, oh, he moved to, Northfield or whatever, and I never, the albums just kind of went away. Right. So Facebook.
No way.
Yeah.
So decades
Facebook,
later.
Decades, freaking decades. I sign up for Facebook. I'm on Facebook for like a year, year and a half. And I go, hey, wait a minute.
I'm still thinking about those Bill Cosby.
One minute, I can find that guy. So I type in Brent Zimple, and he shows up. And I sent him a message, and as all the message said, I didn't even say hi. I didn't say anything. I sent him a message, and I said, "I want my records back." And he
to his credit, in less than 5 minutes, responded back with, "Oh my gosh, Pete, I've got them. They're in the basement. I called my wife. She's going to dig them out. They're underneath a bunch of stuff in some boxes. I'm going to ship them to you overnight. Send me your address." So I'm like, I was like, "Oh, Brett, thanks so much." And I sent him my address. And 2 days later, they show up.
Oh my God.
In this box, all 16. However,
yeah.
Now, my wife, she's very funny about this stuff because she knows I have like this little indignant sort of justice switch that goes, you know. So I open the package. Here they are. It's amazing. And this is before all the stuff had come out, about. And I'm looking at it and I'm thumbing through them and there's a sleeve and the sleeve is empty. And it's the 200 MPH album, the rare one.
Right.
And I'm like, I look at Michelle and I'm like, "There's nothing in this sleeve. It's gone." And she looks at me and she goes, "Don't you dare contact him about, don't you dare come back at him about an album that's 30 years ago you
Did
gave
you
him that's
to
missing."
Michelle?
And I was like, "Oh." And then I flipped through more. There was a double.
Oh.
So it was okay.
That is a fantastic story.
Oh my
he
God.
Probably let go of some guilt himself.
He did. He felt really good about it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was hilarious to me that, he moved out of his parents' house, had gotten married, had moved, like he'd probably moved 6 times since I'd seen him. And he was lugging this box of,
He didn't try to sell them?
Yeah. Really funny.
What's your other nerd origin story?
My other one is that I was really into Avalon Hill war board games when I was a kid, like Blitzkrieg and Africa Corps and Invasion of Crete and the Third Reich and all these like those little games that have like little squares that represent divisions and armies and stuff like that. And there's 45 pages of rules, it's just super
it's
complicated. It even has like the Marshall Plan in it. And it has economics where you have to buy all the troops and you get these BRPs, which are money, and if you invade, then you get 20 extra ones because you have Romania now.
That's
fantastic. And it was just like, I used to play those with my friend Sean, and the game would take 12 hours. You couldn't play it like Monopoly in like an hour and a half. You'd play like, and you'd walk away from it, and you'd come back the next weekend and try to finish. Half the time you wouldn't finish. It'd be like, when is 1945 ever going to come?
I used to work at this gaming company, and a lot of the testers would play a tabletop game during their lunch break, and they had this fancy cover to put over the board game so that nothing was touched.
Absolutely.
For the next 24 hours before.
Nobody can fiddle with it, can they? Nobody can switch out, the SS Corps 15 and move it over to the Belgian countryside.
Cheat this, damn it. I never played that many board games, but I have been recently because we've been covering them on my site, Geek Girl Authority, and I'm getting a bunch of games sent to me by companies and stuff like that. And so my friend Matt Young, he's like, "Well, let's go play Eldritch Horror. It's a Lovecraft game, and this. It's fucking 5 hours.
Oh, it just takes for fucking ever."
I told my husband, I was like, "I'll be home in a couple hours." He's texting me. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. He's like, "Are you okay? Where are you? I was sleeping, and now you're not here." I'm like, "We're still playing this fucking game."
A year and a half ago, my friend Keith Ray and his wife brought over Settlers of Catan.
Oh yeah,
boom,
yeah.
Done. I could like. The problem is that I have a life and I have a son and I'm married and I have a career, blah, blah, blah. And I want to play board games more.
Yeah.
I want to get back into my geek games. Uh-huh. I even went, like over time, the ones that I had got literally musty. They literally got like mold inside of them in the boxes.
Oh, wow.
And I had to toss them because I thought if I open this, I'm probably going to die. Like, unearthing a mummy in Egypt, there's some spore intake that's going to happen.
You're going to create a pandemic.
I'll be in like Cedar Sinai. I'll be like, "We have no idea, ma'am, what your husband ingested. It's a spore that exists in the modern era.
Los Angeles is dead because you.
Yeah,
opened,
because I opened up, you
opened
know, my
that
old
box.
Copy of Panzerleader.
Those damn Nazis.
The damn Nazis, they got me again. 60 years later, the entire nation was put to death. So I want to get back into playing some of those fun games. And there's this great place in Glendale. Have you heard there? What's the name of it? Game House. It's really close. My wife has a shop called Treehouse that's just on Glendale Boulevard in that Atwater Village area.
It's a nice area.
We go to, and it's, every once in a while we'll go down to Game House and play. But I just love the idea of like walking in, there's like 1,600 games on the wall. What should we learn? I don't have enough time for it, but it would be fun to do it.
We've done it once. We just played that game I'm showing Peter. I got this Game of Thrones trivia game where it's not just trivia. You're actually trying to take over Westeros. I don't know if you watched the show or read the book. And then under that is Warhammer Quest. And I have to give that to a friend because I'm not into Warhammer. And that's going to be like a 10-hour game, like you said.
Yeah.
And then I have a Star Wars one.
You know, it's just the updated current versions what's the game that everybody played when we were in high school?
Dungeons and Dragons,
yeah. You know, which I played like once or twice, but just never quite got around to getting into, you know.
Do you feel like you failed because you never became a dungeon master?
You know, I don't like the question. I don't like what's implied by it.
Okay. I ask hard questions on Neil before
I'm an actor. I need to play a character, not the dungeon master guy. That's more utilitous.
Okay, well then you're missing out on something in life.
I guess I am. I guess on grid paper with pencils and creating a little maze. Because that's what my friend used to do. He would like do these. He'd spend hours making like a dungeon, and he would sit there with the 26-sided dice. You know, I mean, the couple of times I played, and I was like, this game is A, interminable, and B, has like every variable you could possibly imagine.
It is pretty insane. Yeah. I have to admit, I never got into Dungeons in Dragons. Although I do know a guy, you know, Wendy McClendon Covey, her husband just created a new booklet for Dungeons and Dragons, and there's an acronym, I can't remember what it is, but it's old rules. This is rules from the like whenever it first came out. Like I guess over the decades it's evolved into new rules, but it's like for people that are
really purists
and want
to go back to the core.
Want to go back to the core
of what it was all about.
Yeah, and I didn't understand any of it, so I sent it to a friend who did to review it because I couldn't review it. It wouldn't be fair.
It's like reading a technical manual. the language. Yeah. Like somebody trying to teach you how to play, you know, 500 or Pfeffer, and all they do is use 500 and Pfeffer terms to teach you how to play 500.
it's like
I don't know
work.
What that means.
Normal language.
So you just lift the dwinkle and turn it on. What's the dwinkle?
Twinkle.
You know what the dwinkle is?
Like a dreidel? Is it? I'm confused. But you were born in California and moved to Minnesota, right?
Yeah, I was born in Monrovia, Arcadia area and lived there until I was about 12. A little time in Highland Park, some time in Temple City when I was really young. And then I moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul with my mother and my dad. You know, they got divorced. My dad stayed out here. My mother moved there, and we moved there with my mother's second partner. My mother came out when I was 11 years old, and her partner was this woman who was a minister at MCC, Metropolitan Community Church, which is like a gay church that was created by Troy Perry in like the 60s, I think. And so she was transferred, and my mom wanted to stay with her, so we went to Minnesota, you know, and you know, the whole time on the drive there thinking about ticks and tornadoes.
Yeah.
That's as a kid, you're like, well, they have ticks. I'm going to get ticks all over me in Minnesota. And there's tornadoes.
Oh, my God.
The tornadoes are going to hit my
head. You didn't think about the winter at all?
The winter, for some reason, didn't strike. Like, I thought, oh, it's going to be cold. Oh, that's not, I don't know, it's cold. You know, I mean, then you're there and you're like, it's terrible. You know,
right.
Like, I remember standing in sixth grade, the first year we were there, standing on the, because you're still at like a bus stop, standing at the bus stop in the middle of winter, it's 30 below, and I've got like the cone jacket on,
like the
Arctic kind where it comes out like a foot in front of your face, and boots and the whole thing. And the girl standing next to me who's 11 years old has no hat on because she doesn't want to muss her hair, no earmuffs. She's wearing regular shoes because like big boots are ugly. You know, and
fashion
just
is
and
more
kind
important.
Of an okay coat,
right,
you know, and
right.
It's like freezing out, you know. So that was a big shock. And my sister and I got teased in middle school a lot because we were outsiders, you know. Uh-huh. Eventually we kind of wormed our way in. But yeah, so I lived there and, you know,
and then
grew up in the southern suburbs. And then
you made it as an actor after you got that first play, and when you're
once the play started rolling in at Gustavus Adolphus College.
No, here's something I read about you. And believe I've done this is my 36th episode, and you are the second person that studied theology in college and became a comedian that I've interviewed.
Interesting. Yeah. Who else?
His name's Matt Key. He went to actually a seminary school, and then was studying theology.
Yeah, I wasn't
there,
in seminary. I mean, my degree was in like theology and history, but
I wanted to go to Chicago Theological Seminary and become like a professor.
Right.
You know, my mom wanted me to be a minister. So my mom kept telling everybody, Pete's going to be a minister. And I was wanted to study, you know, be a professor or whatever. But what I really wanted to do was be an actor, but I just didn't think I could do that. I thought, well, who
right.
does that? You
right.
know? And then a week before I graduated, I thought, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I want to be a fucking actor. So yeah. So I went to the cities and, you know, I got like an intern, but then I got to the cities and I went to Dudley Reese Bravery Workshop and got in the work, you know, the classes, which is basically,
which
like,
is a super it's
second
famous,
city.
Yeah, it's a
yeah,
super
very
famous.
Famous and it's like second, yeah. it's the second city of Minneapolis.
Right,
it's been around
right.
since the 50s, you know, and I took classes there, but I was sort of like, well, I can't, you know, I can't really be an actor. So what I'll do is I'll go into theater administration. I'll go into development where the big money is. And
the
you know,
big money is.
And I got like an internship at yeah. the Illusion Theater, which they were very sweet to me and very great.
Yeah.
They gave me parking money and money for lunch. And
right,
I had this
right.
internship, you know. And then while I was there, you know, the artistic director said, hey, do you want to audition for this show? And then I auditioned for the show and got in. And then I kind of just kept.
Right.
So I did commercials there and voiceover. And I did films when it came to town. I was in Jingle All the Way. And I was in Drop Dead Fred there. You know, some other.
I remember Drop Dead
you
Fred.
You know, and just yeah. I was Go to Hell Herman and Drop Dead Fred. You know, and then shot some TV there, but mostly like commercials. And,
right.
and VO.
During this time,
and stage
was
stuff.
Your mother concerned about your choice? Or since you started
you know
working?
What? Never.
That's great.
That's the thing about my family.
That's
I have
great.
Never, I hear all these stories from people like, oh, my family isn't supportive and my uncle teases me. And I go home and my mom is like, you know, when are you going to get a real job? And you really should have got that engineering. And, and my mother and my family had never one time ever said anything to me that to make me doubt that I could do this. You know, when I would bring up backup plans, it would be me. And
right.
my mom would say, well, you know, okay, well, I guess that's a backup, you know.
Mm.
But she never suggested it. You know, there was a funny time when I was living with my mom and Egan when I first got out of college and I needed to get a temp job. And I got this, I signed up for this temp agency and they sent me to, it was a company like Raytheon, like it was a military contractor
wow.
company that needed, you know, it wasn't Raytheon, I can't remember the name of the company, but it was in Egan and it was like maybe 3 miles from my mom's house. And so every day I would go to this Raytheonish company and I would work in the vault where they have all the drawings of everything, you know, and then the vault, you know, if there's a fire, you're supposed to throw everything in the vault and close the vault,
right.
that kind of thing. But they, you know, they had crap everywhere, you know. And so I would get up in the morning, I'd get ready to go, and my mom would look at me and say, well, off to the bomb factory, which they didn't make bombs, but they made like naval missile guidance systems or something like that. For 6 months, I worked this bizarre job for no reason, like just because it was there.
But you temped? I mean, they didn't give you like a security test or anything?
No, they
like
had
that?
Me in the vault
That's
with the
crazy.
But the thing is, when you think about a vault with drawings, you know, there isn't it isn't like the drawings aren't of, you know, Dr. Evil's missile on
right.
a big, you know, blueprint.
Right,
It's literally a drawing of a bolt. You know, a metric bolt with or it's a drawing of a little plate with two holes in two exact locations. Like there's nothing discernible about any of these drawings because they're all just microcosms of to the layman. That's right. But they didn't give me any secure. There was no security clearance. There was nothing like that. It was just it was me and like all women, and it was just the weirdest job. But then I went to Dudley Riggs, I was in the classes. They said, hey, do you want to be in this show as an intern? You know, $50 a week.
Yeah.
I was so excited.
Yeah.
And then I met Mo there. And then they extended the show and they hired me full time.
Uh-huh.
It was $150 a week. And then they hired me on as a company member for $265 plus, you know, health insurance. You know?
Wow.
So I thought I had made, and it was really quite a training ground, like so many improv sketch comedy places out here.
You had all those comedy albums when you were a kid, so you obviously like comedy. Did you know growing up that you had an ability to do comedy? Did you know that until you got to Dudley Riggs?
I was a very insecure performer for many, many years. And even when I was at Dudley Riggs, I knew that people thought I was funny. I knew I could do comedy. But I kind of lacked a certain level of confidence unless I was absolutely in the moment and forgetting about whether or not I was being any good,
right.
was any good or not. But I think I grew up there quite a bit. And and I started to learn how to write as well there, you know, and I think I left that place maybe a year too early. I think I was sort of at my peak of writing, and then I left and went to do theater at other theaters and stuff like that in town. But yeah, I think, I mean, I loved doing comedy because, and I learned so much from those people, and I learned a lot from Mo too, working with her.
Mo Collins.
Yeah, about the level of just being in the moment and letting things kind of wash over you and affect you and listening and you know. So yeah, it was great. But I mean, I get when you look at my resume, you can see I get cast in a lot of diverse things. I don't just do comedy. Like, you know, I end up casting, you know, one week I'm in CSI and then I'm in Serious Man. Then I'm in the middle and it's interesting. It's been an interesting ride for me. I feel like I fit out here and I have a strong place here, but I seem to get plugged in.
Yeah. All well, over my the place. Snobby point of view, because I did a lot of sketch comedy and growing up when I was younger, and had a really popular group, and my husband's an incredible improviser, and it's such a hard thing. It's like what you were saying about listening and being in the moment. It's such a hard thing to do. I think people with comedy backgrounds actually make better actors, you know, better dramatic actors as well, because, you know, I think it's harder for a dramatic actor to do something funny than vice versa.
I really agree with that. And I know that's kind of an old pat thing to say.
Yeah, I there's know. Something it's that's been sort of, said, but there's
a reason. But I think it's true. Yeah. I mean, because I think that the fact is that the best dramatic performance you've ever seen have been with people who understand, even in the darkest sense, what is hilarious about the human condition in that moment that they're living through in that part of the story, as opposed to the exclusion of that, of how hilarious that darkness can be, you know, because you feel like this is a dramatic scene. So why would there be anything funny about it? And it's like, well, when you function through your day in your own human condition, you're constantly seeing evidence of how funny your life is, no matter how sad it can be.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. I remember during my father's funeral, which was, you know, which sucked.
Yeah,
it sucked. Of course that sucks. And it was a Catholic chapel, and we had to pick. My mom said, "I don't want to pick out the music," because she was going through obviously a very hard time. So she made us pick out the music, and I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore or anything. But I remembered this one song from Catholic school, and I was like, "Oh, I'll have them sing that." And so, and I remember it being a really soothing song when I was a kid. And me and my sister are sitting during the funeral, and the military has showed up, folded with the flag, which is very emotional when they do that and everything. And they have this woman leading the music, and she starts singing this song that I loved so much when I was a kid. It was called "Be Not Afraid," and it was very soothing. And all of a sudden, you hear from the back of the church, "Be not afraid." You know, she was singing it just like that, and the song was really for me and my sister, not my other siblings, because they didn't go to Catholic school. And all we could do was laugh. Yeah. We were laughing so hard to the point where people were looking at us like we were being rude, but it was perfect.
Yeah.
It was absolutely perfect moment, and you needed that kind of catharsis.
Yeah, that's ideal. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't write that. That's just the perfect thing.
Yeah, I could.
I mean, in that context, too, I remember thinking, you know, people ask me, like, well, did you get, you know, studying theology and history, how did that help you in any way in your work that you do now? And I have to say that, you know, especially when I started working at Riggs and writing and, you know, in the acting work as well, studying about why and how people believe is really kind of an impacting thing, whether it's in a theological sense or just belief in general, you know?
Right.
And also, you know, it's a very, you know, studying philosophical theology or studying these kinds of fields, your mind goes from thinking of the world in this narrow space to thinking of the world with your arms wide open, and you're trying to incorporate a lot of ideas, and it's very, you know, it's very mind expansive, and it's very, this is why I'm such a big book learning advocate about, you know, having a liberal arts education, because I think that it teaches you to think in ways that you never would know, that they would never think in on your own, and you're being pushed to do that, and you're getting to places that you wouldn't get on your own without the guidance of somebody who's taught people in the liberal arts to make you go there. You know, so that's why there's a degree of trust when we go get our education. We have to believe that the institution knows something about educating people more than we do.
Right.
even though in the end we create our own space for that and we create our own ideas about it, we have to trust that, well, they say I should take, you know, English 101, so I guess I have to take it. And then you take it and you're like, oh, that was fascinating. I've never read a book that way. Yeah. I've never looked at a book that way. So I think that all those things have, for me, have translated in my life as an actor to make my performance, I think, richer and more complex, not to sound like I'm going blah, blah, blah when I was in the theater. But it really does. I think
you're absolutely right. You know, I always knew I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid, you know, but I was, you said you're really insecure. I was very insecure, very sheltered, very shy. I have obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, so I get very, you know, so when I'm in the moment, it is an amazing thing. That's why I love acting so much. When I'm in the stage, I can be in a moment, which is something I'm not able to do in my regular life, you know, but I'm able to do that on stage, and it's a wonderful freeing. It's bliss, you know. And
after a night of that, you're like, oh my god,
it's endorphins, it's everything, you know. So going to college was very important to me, going from such a, you know, a sheltered household to college, and I majored in theater and to make my parents happy in foreign politics as well. So I had a double degree, and I was just a sponge for that kind of stuff, you know. I just would want to sit there, and I'd sit there and listen, especially my foreign politics class, because I really have, you know, because of my parents' background and interest in that, you know, I'd become a sponge. But my English teacher, you just reminded me, you know, I had to take it. It was called a Gordon Rule class back in Florida. You had to take and you had to write so many words to get your, and it, you pass the class. And the guy's name was Dr. Check. He says, you guys want to write a paper a week or do you want to do one term paper? And everyone said, let's do a paper a week. And I never knew I could write until that class, you know, like he'd say, okay, this week you guys write a poem. This week you guys do this. And he would read the best ones out every week. And every week mine, he wouldn't say the names, but every single week mine was there. And it was very, because I would never share my writing with anybody. And then he said, you can write a beat poem this week or write a short story. So everybody wrote a beat poem and I wrote a 15-page short story. And he gave me the paper back and he said, Audrey, this is great. This reminds me of Ellen Gilchrist, of Ann Tyler, and a couple more female writers. He says, please promise me, keep writing, never stop writing. Then all caps, keep writing, exclamation point, it was all over my paper, never. And I never wrote again for 20 years. I acted and I did all that stuff just because I didn't want to, I'm scared to share, you know, the anonymity of that class where he wouldn't read my name, say my name out loud. And about 5 or 6 years ago, when I got my diagnosis with the OCD, that made my life make sense. And then I just started writing again. And I wrote a show. And now I write for a site. And I write all the time now. But
that's
just took...
fantastic.
Yeah, but it took like 20 years.
And that fear that controls you and keeps you from doing it. You know, it's like I've spent years feeling that. And I still feel that now a lot of times. It's that sense of like, if you write something brilliant and people feel affected by it and think it's impressive, in some sense that puts more pressure on you. It's like, well, now there's an expectation of me. And so I feel like I have to back off from that. You know, and I think that's kind of an experience that a lot of people have. And I know that I've had that where, like, I had, you know, that one professor that wrote on the front of this paper that I had did, you know, if anybody ever asks you if you can write, show them this.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it was just like, so, and this guy was a hard ass. I mean, he beat the crap out of you in class in a good way. You know, you'd write like a 4-page paper and he would write 3 pages, single spaced notes about your 4-page paper as well as the redlining inside the paper, you know. So he was committed to teaching young people how to write, you know.
Do you find time to write now? Because you're working
off and
so much
on,
as an actor.
I mean,
right now.
I want to do more, and in fact, I've kind of set aside a space for myself at my house. I created a new office, and I got to finish, you know, getting it together. I have a production company called Pumpkin Eater Productions, and so far I'm working with a couple of different properties, and I produced a play, Almost Maine, last December, which was great, a year ago. But I'm working with two writers right now on projects, and you know, one of them is a great script that's basically Bridesmaids, but takes place in the North Dakota oil boom. You know, so it's, and another one is sort of an art caper, wonderful sort of Da Vinci Code slash, nice. You know, recovery thing about these two addicts who own a gallery and they end up with a Rembrandt accidentally. But, you know, so working on that stuff with it, but like, I wish I really need to get myself to write more. I think I would be surprised at what I have to say. You know, right. I have a couple of stories in me that I really, really want to get down, but I feel like I've been busy being an actor and being a dad and and doing other projects and doing other people's projects. I've spent my life mostly doing other people's projects and not my own. Yeah. And there's this fear about doing your own because you got to pick the phone up more often and you got to connect with people and you got to finish things and your stuff is what represents.
Well, you know, when I heard that news at Prince died this morning, so I'm crying, you know, and you were running late. So that gave me more time to cry. Uh-huh. And I'm looking over lyrics and all this stuff and Prince. Yeah. And I was reading, you know, Let's Go Crazy, because that one just popped up online. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, I can't remember the line. You got to live your life before the Grim Reaper comes knocking at your door. And I was just like, oh, when Peter leaves, I'm actually going to work on my project today. And so I'll see if I do it. Because I spend so much time on my website, my pop culture website, that the pilot I'm writing, it's so easy to put it. Well, I've got to do this. So let me put this down.
I've been working on a screenplay for my dad's life. My dad, mom and dad were like 16 years apart. And when my mom came out, it was like my dad's whole world exploded and he didn't understand. And like, then he became, and then he sort of lived his life alone, but very, in love with these different women that he thought he was going to get remarried to. And he had he was a fascinating guy and really beautiful, devoted guy and great dad. But it's just such a really interesting story about a man out of time, you know, and it's on cards, you know.
At least you got to the place, you got to write it, so it's around, but
I'll get to it.
And that's a story you know personally.
Oh, I know. I've got like three things that I want to write because I know that you should, you know, if you haven't done a lot of writing, it's really good to do what you know to start, you know, and that's what I feel like I should be doing. But anyway.
So, you know, you got a serious man with the Coen brothers while you were in Minneapolis, right? And then you're out here in LA, and then you get in Fargo, the television series, which they just EP'd on. They really didn't have much to do with that. Much of, they put their names on it.
They
basically
were kind of like, you know, go forth and make good series.
And
you know,
put our names on it so we get some money.
So it's
Noah Hawley thing and everything, right?
Noah, just like the god of writing. I mean, the dude wrote all 10 episodes on his own, the first,
Which I'll get to. One of your lines is one of my favorite all-time lines in history of history. So my very good friend, Kelly Holden, who played Pearl Nygaard in that show, her audition process was like really quick. You know, she went in for audition, a callback, and then she got the part, and she said it went by so quick. It was very strange. Was your audition process different from that? Because you had such a meaty role.
Yeah, I had a weird,
as Lieutenant Schmidt.
Yeah. Lieutenant Schmidt, who was a great part. I got to work with Bob Odenkirk, and I worked with
Billy Bob Thornton.
I was like watching other people at the top of their game working like just soaking it up, you know. But my thing was is that I was trying to get into audition for that thing.
Yeah.
And in Rachel Tenner's office, because my wife and son and I were going on a trip to Indonesia to visit, to stay with a friend of ours who lives in Bali for a while and explore, where I subsequently dislocated my shoulder terribly in the jungle and ended up changing the trip substantially. But that's a whole other story. But we were gonna leave, and I was like, I really want to. Can you get me in on this? You know, my agents at Ellis Talent, my wonderful agents Pam and Gabby, I was like, can you get me in? Can you, you know? And they're like, we're sending your messages, but just it's not happening, and blah blah, you know. And so I didn't get in before we left, and I was really like,
kind of bummed,
you know, just bummed. But I was like, okay, well, so we went on our trip, and I get home, and it's like a jet lag, insane jet lag, you know, coming back, and I'm just like out of my mind. But I get home, and I call them and say, I'm back, I'm home, I know that you knew this was the date, but I'm just telling you I'm here. And she goes, oh my gosh, I'm going to call Rachel right now and see if I can get you in. And I was like, oh, that would be, and I'm like spinning and going, that would be great.
You're like on drugs.
You know, and I'm like, oh my God, okay. So she calls me back like a half hour later and she goes, tomorrow, 10:30.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, I'm out of, like, I'm sick. I'm actually physically sick from the trip because, you know, you get on the plane, you'll get a cold.
Yeah,
so I'm starting to feel ill. having landed and finally my body finally saying, okay, now I can get sick because we're not in a dorm. We don't have the adrenaline running up from traveling and stuff. And so I'm like, I rally, I muster, I get, and I end up reading for Bob Odenkirk's part. They spring me in to read this scene where he's taking her off the case in the coffee shop, you know? So I go in and read that and think I did pretty well, you know, and Rachel's great and she likes me and she's always been a great advocate for me and I adore her. So I was like, it's like, okay. And so I walk out the door, you know, smiles. I start walking down the staircase to get to my car. And every step I took down the staircase, I got sicker and sicker.
Oh, like, then your body's like,
the body
really
finally let go. Like, okay, now you can get sick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So driving home in the car,
it didn't
just
even let you get
mess.
Home.
Yeah. I was just like, you know, and I get back and I don't hear anything for a while, you know, and I don't hear anything. And I'm like, oh shoot. Well, okay. And weeks later she says, they want you to come in and read for this other thing. So when I go in the second time, I go in and Noah's in the room and Rachel's in the room and Warren Littlefield is in the room.
Oh, wow.
You know,
okay.
And so this time it's like there's all three there.
Yeah. Did you know they were going to be in the room?
I think I did. Uh-huh. I didn't know that Warren was going to be there.
Right.
I thought Noah would be there. But and I just killed it. I just killed it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just killed it because I was just in the moment and it was just so – it was just the scene where I'm in the can. Mm-hmm. And he comes in, and I come storming out of the thing. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know, it's that scene, you know. And I just kind of killed it.
Yeah.
And then they looked at me, and they kind of give you that stare. Like, sometimes actors misinterpret the stare. They think the stare is like I'm being judged. Uh-huh. When the stare is really the wheels are turning inside the people casting.
And they're like,
wait a minute. Yeah, this guy could fit right here, you know.
Yeah.
And Warren told me later after I left the room, he looked at Noah, and he said, well, he could do it. That was like the minimalist, you know. And then I heard,
boy, you did it. Yeah,
I heard later. It took a while to hear again, you know, but I did hear, and then I went to Canada and did it. And it was
so what's the? I mean, it's so interesting that there's a show that takes place in Minnesota. It was created in LA, but then it was shot in Canada.
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
It's all economics, you know.
What was the most intimidating part? Was it Billy Bob Thornton? Or Bob,
Billy Bob was really sweet to me. He came into the green room and I was meeting him for the first time and I just said, hey, you know, I'm Peter Breitmeyer. And he looked at me and he said, we kind of have a connection, don't we? And I was like, we do? And what might that be, sir? Dear sir? And because my friend Nick Schenck was working on writing, he had been hired to develop a show for Billy Bob Thornton to be the lead, you know. Uh-huh. And Nick had had some meetings with him, and Nick had mentioned to him, oh, my buddy got cast in this. Oh, and I think, you know, he just remembered the name, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, but I was all excited that he looked at me and said, we had a connection, blah, blah, dee, dee, dee. You know, and then I started to lick him all over about Sling Blade, because Sling Blade's like one of my favorite movies. And he was telling me the stories of making Sling Blade, and you know, and it was very fun. And then I went out to eat with Marty, with Marty Freeman, and
you
and
call
Bob
him Marty.
Marty. Well, at the time.
When Kelly Holden was here and she was talking about them, she said Marty too, and I was like, oh, Marty.
Well, Kelly
Freeman
has his number in her phone. I don't have that. I didn't have, like, when I went to England to shoot Fantastic Beasts. And I came back, Kelly goes, well, did you get a hold of Marty while you were there? I was like, no, I didn't feel, feel like I should try to get a hold of him. I had dinner with him when in Canada and we'd worked together. And then it was so exciting to sit and have dinner with Bob Odenkirk and Martin Freeman. And it's some little Chinese restaurant in some corner, you know, and they're just, and we're all cracking each other up and talking, you know. So that was, but to watch Billy Bob Thornton is amazing because of his stillness and his ability to communicate so much. Mm-hmm. But Marty Friedman is a different kind of thing going on altogether. And it's just
really
fascinating to watch him do his thing. Everybody on it, to the small, like all the, it's a separate character, all the smaller characters were passed so brilliantly. That's the show. I think it's really seriously, not just because I'm on it, I seriously think that the first season of Fargo is one of the best pieces of TV that's ever been on television.
That's undeniable. And then they followed it up with an amazing second season, which is like, what are they going to do with the second season? And then they do that shit with the second season, which was great. And I guess it was what you auditioned with, my favorite line was when you're talking to Colin Hanks and you're telling him you screwed up and he has to look through the mug book. And it's like, you're going to tell him that you screwed up, you absolving the rest of us from any dipshittery.
Yeah. And
you
know? That's the one that everybody always says to me on the street, like, hey, dipshittery.
Yeah. I mean, it immediately became part of our lexicon,
yeah.
You know? And so that's it must great. Be great to get your script and read that and think, I get to say that line.
Oh my God, that was the greatest. When I read that before I had the audition, I thought, I get to actually say
that.
This. And I thought, I was doing the thing where, like, I don't want to do that actor pitfall where it's the line so fun to say that you're leaning on it because of how great, how exciting it is, because how well written it is, you know, because that's hard not to do when you're just loving it. relishing it.
Yes. Fantastic. Yeah, what a joy for you to have
that was a great
been on the show. What do you think of the were you surprised at the cult fandom around it?
Not really.
Yeah.
I thought people are going to there's really going to be the thing I was surprised at was, to be honest, was after it was over, I wasn't busy.
Okay.
Yeah. And
were you expecting phone calls to start coming in?
Well, I thought there'd be more, but what my manager was telling me was that she said, you know, you're not going to believe this, Pete, but I'm calling to get you into meetings and stuff like that. And I'm saying, you know, he was a recurring on Fargo, and he's got cast. She said she had cast directors saying, oh, I haven't seen that yet.
What?
Like, so many people were like, no, I haven't seen that.
Of all people, casting directors should be keeping up with what's going on.
No offense, because casting directors have a very difficult job. There's a lot of things to watch. But, I mean, it's Fargo. It's the Fargo series. It won awards. It was like, how can you not watch that? And I think only in the last, like, year, people have sort of gone back and caught up to watch the first season and then the second season, you know.
And that's kind of the way of things now, where people can actually miss an entire season, but because of binging and all that stuff, you get to go.
And, of course, as an actor, since you're so insecure, you're like, well, why aren't I really busy? Did I suck?
Yes.
I must have sucked.
It's all me.
They must have hated what
I'm
I did
never
on
gonna
Fargo.
Work again.
Yeah, I mean, that's right away your thing, because why wouldn't I be busy based on, you know, this popular show?
But, I got a great segue for asking you about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. I'm proud of my segue. But someone pointed out to me in an interview when I said that before, it's like, Audrey, you shouldn't announce your segues, but I can't help them.
No,
can't
I think
help
you should.
Because,
I think you need to.
Thank you.
It's just, it's as rich as pointing at the joke.
Thank you so much.
You need to announce your segues.
When I was interviewing Kelly Holden, she was talking about the fandom. Behind Fargo, and she said the weirdest thing was, you know, which it was Tumblr, which I don't know if you're familiar with Tumblr. I am. I love Tumblr.
Yeah, I'm not on
it's,
it, but
it's
I know what it is.
Where super fans go to make memes and post their fan art and everything.
Okay.
And she said, I don't know if she told you about this, that a fan of Fargo took the sorting hat from Harry Potter, you know, her own sorting hat in her imagination, and sorted the whole cast of Fargo season one.
Really?
Yeah.
Where did they put me? I didn't see that.
Well, I didn't know you then. We'll have to ask Kelly.
I'm curious. Kelly, during that entire time, was so social media savvy. Like, she was always telling me, like, because we have put kids at the same school.
Uh-huh.
So I'll see her at school, you know, and during that time, she'd be like, what did you hear about? And she's like, knows all these things going on online that I have no idea. Like, I would post stuff on Facebook and I would say, and I, you know, I would see Noah's posts and I was like, and I would, you know, say, hey, watch the show. You know, but she was like, had like 9 different platforms that she was
Facebook page and her Facebook personal profile,
Tumblr,
Twitter,
and this,
you know, it is hard to keep up with, I'll tell you, because there's a new, because now, as my stepdaughter says, Facebook is for old people.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, great. Thank you.
I'm understanding for people, because like all these kids are shifting to things that their parents can't watch them communicate. Yeah,
exactly.
On, you know,
so Snapchat's big, and I'm sure there's another one out there that I don't even know about.
I'm sure.
You know,
there's always something. Yeah.
It's like now, like when I finally got on Instagram, usually I can get Audrey Kearns right away because there's not many Audrey Kearns out there. And, if I'm not right away on social media, there's just one Audrey Kearns in Ireland. She keeps beating me to get into Audrey Kearns.
Stupid bitch.
I'm going to take care of that Irish bitch. All right. So
I need to be able to, I need to stop just for a moment and compliment you on your segue.
Thank you.
I really think
that
the way that you connected those two projects was both fascinating and obscure in a way that always fascinates and always keeps people, you know, on the edge of their seat. Anyway, go on.
Thank you. I'm writing a paper on segues I'll probably never publish because I'm too insecure.
So, well, I'll tell you in advance. I'm sure it'll be awful.
Just okay. Horrible, thank you. So. Thank you for the encouragement. So I won't even do it. Great. So Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is the latest in the Harry Potter universe from J.K. Rowling.
And, baby.
Before we talk about it, were you a Harry Potter fan? Are you a Harry Potter fan? Has your son watched the movies?
Yes. I, of course, had seen the movies in the theaters as they came out and loved them all, but hadn't read the books. My wife had read all the books, like, in it well before it was, had even become a... She had, her big thing was like, I read Harry Potter before, and they were even thinking of making a little movie. Yeah. You know, and my son is a reader, but he... That's... It's a little above his pay grade,
right?
Regular, you know. I mean, some kids his age are reading that kind of stuff, but he's reading a lot of. He likes reads a lot of comics and he reads graphic novels and he reads like, and he's into, you know, non-fictional books about how things work and stuff like that, and, and you know, the craziest
so he's
animals
be a
in the
dungeon
world.
Master.
Yeah, yeah, he's that kind of. He's like an engineer kid, which we love, but. So yeah, I was into it, but I wasn't like a freak about it,
right?
You know, and I knew that the freak world was out there. And I was excited about that because I thought, ooh, there's a whole freak world of people, of freaks that love this. And so that, and that audition.
Yeah, so tell me about the audition.
Well, it was with Tanis Fowley, who I think is one of the greatest cast directors in town.
Now, it was filmed in London, but the audition was here.
Fiona Weir is the casting director in London. She's the primary casting director. But I auditioned at Warner Brothers with Tanis Fowley, who is a wonderful casting director over there, who was casting Americans for the project for Fiona.
Right.
And she was just like, oh my God, I've never had an audition like that that was so relaxed and great. Like, because she spent like 25 minutes with me.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
She taped, you know, it was a tape. She taped it. She taped a little interview, like 2-3 minute interview. And then we read, and I did three different reads. And each time she's like, well, do you got another? I said, yeah, I got another idea. Let's do it. And I kind of was excited. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got another angle in this I could do. And I hadn't even thought of this before the audition. So I did like three reads. And she was, and then she shut the camera off, and then she sat there and talked to me for 18 minutes. Just she and I, not even being sent to London for anything, just like, and I have to shout out to her to say, you know, she made me feel so comfortable and she brought out the best of me because of the way that she worked with me in the room. And I know casting directors have a very difficult job, so you don't have time to do that kind of work with people in most audition situations, especially for TV and stuff like that. Right. But this is a film, and film auditions, there's a little more of a, you know, they have more available time, you know. And I walked out of her office and there was a woman sitting there waiting. I don't know how long she'd been waiting, you know, the poor woman, you know. But and then, you know, I heard, you know, a few weeks later, I think, that, you know, my agent's like, there's an offer coming in for, you know, I'm like, you gotta be shitting me, really.
Wow.
I mean, I felt good about the audition, but I thought, oh my God, this
was
is
this
just
about
such
a year
a huge,
ago? Or?
Yeah, this is like, a little less than a year ago, actually. And so then, you know, the whole process began of, you know, dealing, negotiating, and then you know, going to London, and then the shoot was, you know, up north in the studios where they shot the 007 movies and recently shot Tarzan and
which David Yates did.
Yeah, David Yates,
director.
And it's just this massive studio out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and you stay at this fantastic, this beautiful hotel where they have like G8 summits and stuff like that because it's so remote and it's surrounded by these gigantic golf courses so they can be defended easily, you know.
Right.
But and I after 3 days, and it was an incredible privilege, but I just started joking after 3 days that I was in a luxurious prison because to get anywhere, you know, I had to like, but then I fell in love with it because I was walking to town. The nearest town was like 2.5 miles, and I'd walk along these English channels and all these channel, these little English sort of man-made channels with houseboats in them. And the houseboats are all shaped like cigars. They're like 6 feet wide and like 35 feet long so they can pass each other.
Because
the
they're so narrow.
So narrow. Yeah. So the channels are like 20 feet wide or whatever. And they have all these locks and it was just, you know, and it was just very, basically where I was staying was the absolute American conception of the bucolic English countryside in its most, it was exactly what you would imagine in your head if you were thinking bucolic English
they
countryside.
Gave that to you.
they handed it to me on a platter. Yeah. So I went in, you know, and I was there for 9 days before I shot. I was there for a couple of weeks and.
How long did you shoot for him?
A few days.
Yeah, just
a few. And it, it, I, you know, I did, I had my wardrobe and then I met David and I had my mustache fitting and this and that, you know.
Mustache fitting. Yeah. I love it. That's fantastic.
That's all I can tell you about that. and I was, you know, they had this beautiful set that I worked on that was my office in it. And,
oh, I love that universe. You know, I really do.
It was so great. I mean, I felt so it was so wonderful to be working on something that had like just gigantic resources and you walk into this thing they've built for you and you're like, oh my God, this is just meticulous.
Yeah.
Like everything down to the last detail is perfect,
right,
you know. And that was really fun.
Well,
and
one thing I love about J.K. Rowling's work is she comes up with the best names for her characters, you know? And so your name is really, is Gilbert Bingley? Is that how I say it?
Yes.
I read it. I was like, that's a total J.K. Rowling name.
And that's the thing about, like, as an actor, when you see Gilbert Bingley, you're like, I know exactly who this person is.
Right.
Like, you're already 50% done with it. I mean, not in all cases, but in some cases, that if the name is that distinct, you're like, okay, I know who this person is already.
Right.
You know? And, it was, the set was wonderful. David Yates, one of the funniest things happened 2 weeks before I got there, I got a call from David Yates' assistant, or first my agent said, David Yates' assistant is going to call you. I was like, oh, okay, great. Okay, I'll make sure that I have mouth washed. And and he calls, he says, Mr. Yates would like to talk to you next week on Thursday at like 10 a.m. Is that okay? I was like, absolutely, it'd be great. So I'm like, the call's coming, and it's like a week away, and I'm preparing. I'm like researching his films and making sure I've seen all the movies and done all this stuff and know things about it. And I've taken notes and everything because I just don't want to be an idiot when he calls, you know, and I don't know what he wants to talk about, you know. So he calls me and he's, hello, Peter, how are you? I just want to let you know I have a wonderful set of her and everyone's so wonderful. It's just going to be a lot of fun. And I just want to tell you, we love what you did at the audition and we just want you to come and we'll just play and we'll have a good time. And I said, well, is there anything you would like me to, he says, do you have any questions for me? And I said, is there anything you'd like me to think about or work on before I leave? And he goes, you know, I don't really want to give you any notes because I don't want to muss you up, you know? And I think you brought this humor to it in the audition that other people didn't. And it was very nice, you know? And so he was just very sweet to me. And he said, just come and we'll play with
it. So he was basically calling to say, hey, and
he's
welcome.
Checking in. Yeah, he was calling to welcome me and he was checking in and he wanted to make sure that everything was okay. And, it was like a 5-minute, 10-minute call tops, you know, and I said, I love the period. He's like, yes, it's wonderful. And he said, you fit right in visually. Yeah. You're just, you know, and I was like, I feel grateful for that. I feel like I could be in any film that was shot in the 20s or the 40s, you know, with the right haircut, you know. And, and then I went and I had wonderful experiences like actually having a conversation with, you know, Eddie Redmayne.
You did like, get to.
And then the first 5 minutes of the conversation is, I'm having a conversation with Eddie Redmayne. Oh, now I'm listening to him after 5 minutes.
I have no idea what he's talking about because
no, but I mean he was really a delight.
Did you love your costume? Did you love it? Was it like really nice and tailored for you? Or
everything is beautiful on those kinds of shoots. Yeah,
wow.
everything is dreamy. Yeah. You know, and you look great, you feel great, and everybody is a pro.
Yeah, it was a really great vibe on the set. Everything.
Yeah, everybody was great, and it was all high class and highly professional. And,
that's great.
And I love my costumers and my makeup artists. Those people were wonderful too.
Right.
And told a lot of fun stories. And, you know, it's so funny cause you go in and you work for a couple weeks or whatever you're there for, but these people have been, you know, there for a few months before you got there. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be a few months after you leave, you know?
Right.
You know, I went to London a few times because I had all this time, but I didn't want to go crazy because I wanted to be ready. And I was on hold a few days and then it was like, oh, you're not working today, but I'd be ready to work. But then they wouldn't work, you know, which is just how it goes, you know? Uh-huh. And so I went to London and I saw a play or two and I explored, and I don't have a problem with doing a lot of stuff on my own. I mean, I get a little lonely after a while, but for the first week and a half, I was okay. I missed my wife and my son a bit, but I was kind of exploring as much as I could and resting and getting
great thing to be able to do while you're doing a film.
That's
now since you come in and you do one part, which isn't the entire film, with big movies like this, do you get to read the entire script, or are you only reading what you do?
They did send me, they did give me the entire script, and they give it to you in this sort of secured way,
so
you can't be doing anything else with
it. Do you have to hand it back to them and they burn it, or do you have it in a vault?
Well, no,
or?
it's one of those things they send where it's like they send it to you and you have a code and you go into it, and every time you go into it, you have to put the code in.
So they can
and you're not, so it's almost like you're reading it remotely, like it's never on your computer, you know?
Oh, that's smart.
Which is smart of them. And there's a time limit to how long you have access to it. You know what I mean? Like it's this many weeks or whatever.
Right,
and
then
after those weeks, your code doesn't work anymore kind of thing.
Right.
But of course I got my pages, like when I was there, I got actual hand pages, but I'd gotten my own individual pages before, but the script in total, it was a very big secret and still is.
Well, I won't ask you about that, but did you read it are you excited about it?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Really,
I just
excited.
Love that universe.
It's
so
a
much.
Really neat, I mean, it's a neat story, you know, it takes place, you know, the thing that I'm saying things that everybody knows. This one takes place in New York in the 20s, but it's still the world of, it's still Harry Potter's magical world.
But we get to find out a little bit about the American Wizarding World, which we haven't known about, and we learn about the Wizarding Congress.
Some of the terms are different and stuff like that, too.
Is it pronounced nomage or nomadge? Instead of muggles in this film, Americans don't use the term muggle. They say nomage or nomad.
Yeah.
Like no magic. They can't do magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, do you know which it is? Nomage.
The second one.
Nomad.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah.
That makes sense. No magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds very, it would certainly be an American way to do it. To hit it on the nose like that.
Exactly. Not come
the
up with nomad. Like, it's like, what the hell does muggle mean?
Yeah.
But here, was J.K. Rowling ever on set?
No, I never met her. She wasn't there.
Yeah.
I mean, she might have been there another day, but I was just
curious.
For me. Like, it's funny, like, too, you know, because, you know, this studio was very large and they had done lots of interesting movies there, you know, and there were remnants of other sets there and stuff like that that were just, monolithic, you know, and so that, you know, they went to a lot of trouble. That's for sure.
Well,
as
they
as
have
you would
the
assume,
money too. Yeah,
because
they know that this is going to make money, and you know that's why they're doing three films of it. Here you are, and now you're going to be a part of another huge fandom. You know, like for this one's going to be even bigger, and more hardcore.
Yeah, maybe,
You know, because I just have you Googled your name and Gilbert Bingley and Fantastic Beasts.
I haven't actually.
Well, I was trying to, because, you know, I was preparing for my interview, which I want
which
to
is
do.
Wonderful.
You know,
thank you.
And a lot of Harry Potter sites came up, fan sites, saying Peter Breitmeyer has been cast as a character named Gilbert Bingley. We have no information about this character, but we do know that he has been cast and he will be filming in London. And they write a whole paragraph that says absolutely nothing about what, but they're so excited that they know somebody. So you're already in all these, like in the official wiki and all these fan wikis as Gilbert Bingley. So you're forever, like I did under 5 on that TV show Angel, you know?
And I did too.
You did?
Many years ago,
You're forever in that fandom too. I mean,
that's so funny.
Yeah, and I was basically cut out, you know? It's like, blink and you'll miss me, you hear me talking, but it's like going over a crowd scene because they edit it, you know, which happens a lot. But still, you know, I had someone find my email and ask me for an autographed headshot. And it's like, I remember you so well from the, and it's like, that's bullshit because the character I played was called Young Woman, you know, and I wasn't even
I remember
in there.
You, Young Woman,
so well. But those are such strong fandoms. Are you excited about that?
I am. I kind of, it's so funny. I've never been one to, I don't know why this is. This is an oddity about me. I've had situations, for instance, where I'll be on a show, like I'll be on CSI or I'll be on this, and the episode will come and go, and I'll be like, "Oh God, I was on that episode last night, wasn't I?" Like I, Like, I won't always be on it. You know, I'm not the best at like, I'm trying to get better at sort of making people aware of the work I'm doing and stuff
like that.
Because my assumption sort of always ends up being like, well, you know, if they like the show, they'll it's just like, I don't know. But I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to do false modesty. I'm just saying it's a characteristic of mine where I need to, like, I don't pay as much attention as I should. And so the fandom thing stuff, like all the stuff that was around Fargo was all exciting, but I didn't, I was like getting it secondhand, like from Kelly or whatever. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's great, you know?
Right, right.
But I don't go on, like every once in a while I would go on and sort of, I would look at stuff that Noah was posting or look at some different, you know, this and that. But I just didn't, what interested me, and honestly, I'm not trying to sound haughty, but what really interested me was the project, was going in and doing this really fascinating, like doing these fascinating projects. Like I was in the middle for recurring, and it's just this really fun, great comedy, you know, with Patty Heat and those guys. And they're
in the middle.
And it's just, you know, and they're, and my family loves that show, you know, and it was really fun to do that, you know, but it's like, to me, I love just going in and doing the work, and then I catch myself out, you know, on TV or for Fargo, like I had a whole thing in my house. I projected it on an outdoor screen and had people over every week between like 18 to 30 people sitting in my yard, you know, watching it as it was being played, you know?
Right.
And so sometimes for that kind of thing, I was very, very excited, you know?
Uh-huh.
And for the Coen Brothers movie, Serious Man, like there's, I don't get real nervous. I certainly don't get nervous for commercial auditions anymore. And for theatrical, I get just the right amount of even preparing for
nerves that help you.
Nerves that help me. But there's certain projects where you really, really, really want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally I prepare, I go in, I do my best, and then I go have lunch. And I try not to do the, you know, beat yourself up on the way to the car or thinking for 10 minutes about, I could have done this or I could have done that, because hopefully you've done the work enough that you did that stuff when you were in the room so you can feel good when you leave, you know. But there's certain things that you're sort of like, you really do ruminate and like, God, man, this would be great to get, you know, this is a fantastic, these directors, fantastic. Like, I did the Clint Eastwood movie Changeling, and that was like another one where I thought, it's like, if I can get in this, because he's a legend, you know, no matter what you think of his politics, the guy's, he was a great guy. He was really nice to me, and it was an interesting movie.
I heard that about him on set, that he's like a really nice
guy. Oh, he's great. He and the Coen Brothers, the sets are so, the pro level is so extreme that there's no yelling, there's no voices raised of any kind. It flows, you know. For the Changeling, that, you know, we had these huge lights, and they one of them deflated in the middle. We had 400 extras, and we're shooting this big scene, and it's all 1926 or whatever, and this light deflated and the light started coming down, you know, before they could start shooting. And there wasn't like, get the blah 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 blah. It was just like, immediately people shot into action.
Took care of the problem.
You know, we you know, Clint stood around and talked to the extras and talked to people and made jokes for like 15 minutes. And then somebody came up to him and said, okay, we're ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just like slick as shit.
Yeah. You know?
I just like that, you know, people reuse a lot of the same people over and over and over again because they like to work a certain way and they know that people are going to be ready. And so,
and there's trust.
I don't know how I got off on this, but
but it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, you were talking about commercials, and so you've done a string of commercials for Progressive and the Progressive campaign. Is that another company? It's an agent from another.
Yeah, the Another Insurance Company. Brad and I have done like 18 commercials at this point.
Right, and you've done a few of them with Stephanie Courtney, who plays
almost. Yeah, most
Flo.
Of ours are with Steph. Yeah, who
now,
we love.
But she's great. She's great. Now, she, like you, is just, you know, an amazing improviser. Do they stick to the script a lot on the Progressive commercials?
Well, they stick to the body.
Yeah.
I mean, there's improvising inside the body sometimes too, and they're always changing. Like, you know, they stick to the, but it's the tags, it's the endings that get shifted. Like, we'll do, you know, Brad and I'll do 20 different endings or 20 different combinations of endings, you know, for the end of a spot, you know. But so a lot of the body of it will stay the same because it's the information about the product,
right,
of course.
Right.
And even for her, it's a certain thing. But they're always rewriting on set first progressive. They're constantly rewriting things. They're constantly changing. They're constantly, and the director, we've Brad and I've worked with primarily just two directors. Uh-huh. In the first, like, you know, nine spots, we work with one guy, and now we're working with another guy. And they're both great in their own right. And they, you know, sometimes they let us go, and sometimes he's got a list of things that he wants us to try. And and then in the middle of that, we'll say, well, how about this though? What about this one? What do you think of this? And it's like, oh yeah, do that one, you know? And, you know, as with many commercials, you have a lot of fun on the set. You do a lot of stuff that is hilarious. Uh-huh. And then when the commercial comes out, it's kind of milquetoast.
Yeah.
It's still funny, but it's sort of milquetoast, you know? Yeah. And that's just the nature of, you know, the level of risk taking is just so much. And this is not like a jab at the people that are producing wrestling, because these commercials are really funny and people love them, but they have a job to do too. And it's like, we can't use that ending because it's too, it distracts from what we're trying to do, or it's just too much or whatever.
Right.
But we sure have a lot of fun on set doing all the different endings, you know.
Well, at least you can go to that job and have a great time and play.
And sometimes they do use like the more outlandish stuff every once in a while. You're like, oh, look at that. They edited it in. That's great.
You know? So here's a question. If you're, say, at Ralph's, which is our grocery store, Ralph's or Vaughn's or a grocery store, and you were to get recognized, would it be more often from the progressive commercials or as Lieutenant Schmidt?
What do you think?
I'm going to say the progressive commercials.
Of course.
Because
it's in people's face every day.
Yeah.
You know, it's on cable channels and it's on network, or as my friend Amy calls it, old lady TV.
That's fantastic.
You know, and so it's like, it's always the progressive thing. And the thing is, initially, you know, like, you know, it's just so stupid because initially you're like, oh, didn't you see me on Fargo? Series Mayor?
Would you like to see my resume?
I mean, I have a reel I can show you. I have like a comedy reel and a drama reel.
I do stage as well.
I did a movie called Big Guns. Do you want to see that? You know, I did this movie called Coffee Kill Boss, which I think is like some of my best work I've ever done. Nobody's fucking seen Coffee Kill Boss. You can buy it on iTunes. You know what I mean? But it's like
Coffee Kill Boss.
Eddie Jameson is in it. Yeah. Chris Wilde. You know, Zibby Lou. Like, there's all these great people in it. But it's like, but nobody's seen it. You know? And so it's like, you know, so like you kind of like you pl- you know, you're like a little pouty. Like, well, you're not recognizing me for the things I want you to recognize me
for my work.
but you know, progressive is my work. I mean, we, you know, it's fun work, and we're Brad and I couldn't be more grateful for it and happier to be involved. You know, we're friends. We were friends before
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's one of those.
That's great.
It was one of those unusual situations where we got cast. And
did you actually get teamed up at the audition?
No, I got cast, and then he got cast separately. And we didn't know. And then 2 days before we shot, we found out that it was the two of us. And we were like giddy at schoolgirls. Let's carpool, you know, to the shoot. It's in Long Beach. Oh, good. It's even a longer drive, you know. And so, you know, so we started carpooling to the shoots. And we would, we weren't as close a friend. We were friends in Minneapolis, but we became closer friends here. But then all of a sudden we got this job, and it was like, and it was supposed to be just one spot.
Yeah.
You know, originally it was just a one off, you know,
so
and then
many.
It became this thing, you know,
and print and online and all that.
Yeah.
All
so
that
we were
stuff,
like
yeah.
all excited that we got to do it. They did this ridiculous, hilarious industrial film for Progressive that was on the Progressive website for a while. I don't know if it's there. I don't think it's there anymore, but it was this exercise video that they had us doing. And honest to God, it was like 15 minutes long. And it was just one shot. Like, it just kept going and going. And it was just like, and mostly no talking.
Yeah.
Like, we're stretching. And then every couple of minutes, they would kind of flash us from behind camera, and we would shift to the other stretching position.
Oh, wow.
And there'd be some grunts and a couple little words in between, maybe. And it was just the most surreal. It was like a David Lynch thing on Progressive side. And that was like just, and we, you know, and we're not in the best of shape.
Right.
I mean, we're healthy men, but there's a certain Buddha aspect going on.
You've got a dad
and they had us in leotards, you know, so we've got like unitards on and we're stretching on the, you know.
Well, they've done, you know, now that I got to say about the Progressive commercials, now that they've gone on, they've gotten super creative. The ones they did with Steph over Christmas with her playing every character in
that
the family.
Spot,
I was like, oh my God.
I just texted her about that the other day saying, you are a god for that. That's so funny. Her playing like the five different family
That's
members.
Fantastic.
I have to hand it to them. They have been incredibly creative with those spots. And some people come down like, I don't get the one where she's out in the rain and it's like, screw you. It's great because they're doing different stuff.
Yeah.
You know, everything doesn't have to be on the nose. Everything doesn't have to be, you know, it's like they're still getting their message across. Everybody knows. Like there's Flo Halloween costumes. Little girls dress up as Flo. I mean,
Facebook,
come on.
You know, getting in touch with people from high school. There's this girl I know from high school. I haven't told her I know Stephanie because I think that'd be really, really weird. But she works at Progressive, and every year they have their Halloween party, and she dresses as Flo every year. I'm like, oh my God, the girl that lived across the street from me for 10 years is dressing up like somebody I know for
Think
Halloween.
Think about it. It's a corporate insurance character.
Yes.
And people are, she's become an American icon.
Yeah. It's iconic. It's crazy. So what's on the horizon for you now? Do you have anything coming up? Or?
Just, you know, I had, you know, this pilot season was a little, it was okay, but, and just continuing to audition for upcoming projects, and I'm probably doing a play this fall with a friend of mine who we've produced together before called 10 out of 20 or 10 out of 12. Sorry. It's basically the play is a play within a play. It's a tech rehearsal that the audience is sitting through a tech rehearsal and everybody's wearing headsets. You know, that's the plan. The plan is to do that in the fall. And then I've got these script projects that I'm working on. You know, one's at an outline stage with this guy, this art caper, and the other one is full completed, and I'm trying to kind of get people to see it. But and then just trying to, you know, get my own writing going, you know. So
get beyond the cards.
I've got a few different burners going.
Yeah.
But as far as like on camera stuff, I'm just kind of like a lot of other journeyman actors. I'm out there, you know, hoofing it and auditioning and stuff like that.
Right.
And nothing in the immediate horizon, but I do work regularly.
But you never know. You could get a call when you leave today.
Yeah. Pretty regularly.
Which is great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
What's your favorite Prince song? Or do you have one?
Well, I mean,
if you're like, that's such a hard question because there's probably
a
million.
That's a really hard question.
Like, shoot off three or four that you love.
Well, I mean, I love Purple Rain. Uh-huh. I love the whole Purple Rain album because that's from my childhood.
Right.
You know, I mean, what can I say? Like, I mean, I'm getting heartbroken just thinking about it. I mean,
because I'm going to play it out.
What are your favorites?
It's going to be anything from Purple Rain, like you said, because that's, you know, when I grew up. And then this is for serious, because that's proper grammar. three or four days ago, I was like, I'm in the mood to listen to Alphabet Street.
Yeah.
And because I just love that song. So I just downloaded that one song and I played it. And I went for a walk and played it like 10 times over on my walk.
Yeah.
So that's was the latest one that was in my head.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Yeah, I'm at where he's going to be missed. But, you know, it's like he's got a large enough, like I have to go back and listen to things that I haven't listened to forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and the thing is, he used to be part of my regular rotation, and then he's kind of, you know, you kind of go to these other things and they can, so now I feel like I want to put him back in.
You know? Well, I think a lot of people will be because this is going to bring up a lot of emotions. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming over.
It was
and
really,
doing this.
Really fun.
Oh, I'm so glad you
I'm
enjoyed
so glad
it. And I'm so glad you kneeled the whole time. Thank you.
Of course. And thank you for the knighthood. And
you're welcome.
Next time you could use a little bit less sharp blade, but it's okay.
Okay.
You know, my shoulders.
Well, I gave you a Band-Aid.
And the knee pads.
Yeah.
We're okay.
Well, that was by suggestion. I've permanently injured some of my guests, so I give knee pads.
These are hard.
And I am a ex-Catholic, so I'm used to the cushioned pews.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I have those kneeling boards for you. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you so much.
I never meant to call you in your sorrow. never meant to cause you any pain. I don't want to one that sees laughing.
supplicants, you may now rise. The merciful Odd has chosen to spare you. Please exit the internet to your left.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.